Well, make sure you show up at it.
We have the blue man, please. We have the blue man. Good. We call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this March 13th of the year 2017. And start with an announcement. We will not be hearing a public hearing on House Bill 2524. That's off the agenda. There are common things, and we can talk about 2524. We talk about other bills. And I do want to announce with delight that it's a diabetes day today in the legislature. My friend and former representative Scott Bruins in the audience, his wife, who's very much involved in diabetes. It's a very important disease. Scott, when he was in the building, made some very significant contributions to dealing with it. We appreciate those and recognize them today and welcome you all. We're going to have some... is there an OHA representative here today?
Sarah.
Here we are.
Yes,
Sarah.
She's in the audience.
Could you join us up here for a moment?
What are you gonna...
I just want to send a message along. No, if you would...
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You don't have to.
Okay.
As a general rule, he doesn't bite too much, though.
But sometimes we received an odd fiscal on House Bill 2398. I'm going to pull that bill off the agenda today. It would be very helpful if you could find a way for OHA to solve the problem to begin with. And the notion is pointing it out to you, causing you to hire a new staff person, doesn't seem to be the best way to do it. So if you take the message back, I'd like you to work with the proponents of the bill and the opponents of the bill together, because they both think you should solve the problem. It would be very helpful. But I think it deals with a very important issue, the issue being Medicaid members are getting bills that they shouldn't get and are getting sent to collection agencies for bills that are probably illegal, but some weird thing going on. It would be very helpful if you would try it.
Chair Greenlee, I will take the message back and we will work on it.
I really appreciate that. And sorry to pick on you today. You were the only one who acknowledged. Smart.
Bravely raised their hand.
All those other OHA representatives kept quiet. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
So that announcement, the work session for House Bill 2398 will be rescheduled. We've got some bills today. We're focusing on the issue of what it takes to increase the provider supply in rural areas and other shortage areas. We have things that come into the loan repayment approach to motivating healthcare behavior. We have tax credit things. It's a little confusing to me, if not to everybody else on the committee, how these things work. We've asked Chris Allerich to join us to talk about the tax credit situation and how that flows now. And we do appreciate Allerich being here to help us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So I was asked just to talk about the tax credit review process. I think many of you have heard this before, but there are some new members who may not be familiar with the process. Over the past few sessions, the legislature has set up a detailed review process of tax credits to basically... All of the tax credits have been sunsetted, and then as they come up for sunset, a review of the policy, and this would apply to new credits or expansions of existing tax credits, where the idea is really to be clear about the policy purpose or the goals of the tax credits, especially going in so that there can be evaluations down the road as to whether or not those goals are being met and those purposes are being served. With the goal of refining tax credits and refining that policy to be as efficient as possible with public dollars. So generally, the process, the tax credits go out to the policy committees such as this one, And those policy committees debate the merits of a tax credit policy and decide on what would be the best way to move forward. And then that tax credit would be forwarded on to JTAX, the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, which is simply the House and Senate Revenue Committees. And that committee, that Joint Committee, doesn't meet until mid-May. So the policy committees do their work and forward the tax credits that they deem worthy to JTAX. And JTAX undertakes what is effectively a ways and means-like process to take those tax credits and see how much money is in the budget for tax credits. And that budget is determined by a number of discussions with the revenue chairs and the ways and means chairs and leadership chairs. So the task or the request of the policy committees is a clear review of what is desired by establishing this policy and offering the tax credits. So one of the things I've been talking to committees about this time around is establishing metrics. So Chair Greenlee mentioned increasing the supply of certain providers. So if that's the key intent of the policy, it might be helpful to, for example, get an understanding of what the supply level is right now in the various parts of the state and establish that information now and the desired increase from the implementation of the tax credit. So then in 6 years or so, when the tax credit gets reviewed, there is some hard data to come back and evaluate the tax credit to at least ask other questions and more informed questions. They may not be the magic question that provides a clear answer to everybody involved. Those are pretty rare.
Yeah.
But the more information that can be gathered and the clearer the legislature can be about the intent of the policy, the better the stage is set for review down the road. So that's kind of a quick overview of the process and establishing any of that information. And the Joint Committee on Tax Credits really looks for advice from the policy committees, because the policy committee can come up with a litany of ideas, and any information and input that can be provided to JTAX helps them make any decisions they need to with any budgetary restrictions on tax credits. So any sort of priorities within the policy that you would recommend.
How does that information come, Chris?
Which information?
We have some opinions about bills. We might say any one of them might be useful, mm-hmm. but do we send along a memo of priority, or how do we transfer our policy view of it to the committee?
It's varied from committee to committee. Some committees will send a memo, and those memos, so they can write up a detailed process where, say, there's an expansion of a tax credit, and here's the goal. So if funds were unlimited, this is the policy that you'd like to see implemented. And then perhaps a scale back of that if funds are not unlimited, which they never are. And so that can take the form of a memo. Sometimes the chairs from the policy committee will come down to JTAX and talk to the committee and make themselves available. It kind of depends on the nature of the recommendation and how detailed those changes might be.
We might have some that are essentially running out. And then the question would be, should you continue them at the current form, current level, or expand them? Then we might have some new proposal, which we do, add pharmacy to that. So, I mean, in a sense, we might want to say, well, everyone would be great if you have enough money, but this one would have priority over it, or, I mean, we should, I don't know how we get to that, but we should try and get to that in a fairly formal way, I assume.
Right. So if on that one, if you're talking about extending the tax credit and expanding it to pharmacists, if that turns out to be too expensive, then the policy committee would like to see which first. Would you like to see a scale back of the tax credit for everybody, or focus on the extension first and then the expansion, those kinds of things? I mean, I don't want to limit any deliberation that might occur, because the ideas can come from any corner as to how the policy might be amended.
Do our bills all have subsequent referrals to the joint? tax credits to me, the ones that are tax credits?
No, Mr. Chair. Some go straight to revenue, some go to Ways and Means, and some go to the JTAC. So not all of them are set to go to the same.
Well, the Ways and Means would not be a tax credit, I assume.
No,
the Ways
no, no.
and Means would be the loan repayment. Right?
Correct, correct.
I have, Mr. Chair, I have noticed that when the tax credits that are before the assembly this time, they're kind of in two pots. There are those that are existing tax credits, and they're the sunset ones. And those have usually have the JTAX referral. Other tax credits, I've noticed that's been a little hit and miss. Sometimes it's to JTAX, sometimes it's to a revenue committee. Usually in the process, just through the normal process, we catch those and then have discussions about whether or not they should go to JTAX. And so it wouldn't be unusual to put a referral to JTAX.
The revenue chair prefers that if they're tax credit, yes. If they're tax credits, they go to
yes.
the joint committee.
That's my understanding as well.
I think it would be useful for us to just assume that for those that are tax credits. The loan repayments, you have it. How do we balance a loan repayment against a tax credit?
That is the unenviable task of the committee, is to evaluate those. You'll hear from a lot of stakeholders on that. But I think the questions would be along the lines of who benefits from which of the programs? Are they complementary? How do they interact? Are the recipients of the loan repayment the same as those for the tax credit? And do you want them to overlap, or do you want them to not overlap? Would you like them to serve different constituencies, if you will?
We've been told, at least we may hear some testimony on it, that one or the other of those is better for recruiting physicians to an area, and the other one is better for retaining physicians and other health personnel in an area. I don't think there's much evidence in that, although we've asked the Rural Center on Rural Health at OHSU to give us some information about it. I expect we'll get some testimony.
Yes,
are there any other questions? Chris? Well, thank you very much. We'll see what we can make of it.
Okay.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2373. And Madam Administrator, what have we got here?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2373 comes at the request of Representative Wilson. It expands the rural health care income tax credit to include pharmacist services performed in rural areas. It directs the Office of Rural Health to establish criteria for certifying pharmacists as eligible for the credit, and it applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2018. Michelle Binker is here from Rep. Wilson's office, if she wants to come up first, and then we'll have somebody on the phone, Mr. Chair.
And following this, we'll have a similar hearing on occupational therapy.
Oops. Sorry.
9. Wait a minute.
Welcome to AT&T's teleconference service. Please enter your access code, followed by the pound sign. To join the conference as the host, press star. Please enter your host password, followed by the pound sign.
Isn't this interesting?
There are two participants on the call, including you. You are joining your conference as a host. For a menu of available commands, press star pound.
Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Greenlit, co-chairs, and members of the House Health Care Committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Binker. I'm Chief of Staff for Representative Carl Wilson, here to talk to you about House Bill 2373. The bill would amend...
Hold on a moment.
Beg your pardon.
Can you hear on the phone all right?
Anne, are you on the phone?
Yes.
Can you hear?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Would you please mute it in the meantime? Go ahead. I'm
Thank
sorry.
You. House Bill 2373 would amend ORS 315.616 to extend rural provider tax credit to include pharmacists. The tax credit exists to incentivize providers to locate in underserved rural parts of the state. And from speaking with several of these rural pharmacists, I understand that this actually has more of a retention effect than an incentivizing to locate effect. Currently, the tax credit is available to certain dentists, podiatrists, optometrists, licensed physicians, licensed physician assistants, nurse practitioners, nurse anesthetists, and volunteer EMS providers. Extending the tax credit to pharmacists, who are among the most highly trained of all medical providers, makes good sense. A recent joint study by Oregon State University and OHSU determined that hospital readmissions are higher in areas of Oregon with less access to pharmacy services. This study and other articles detailing this phenomenon, including letters of testimony, are available to you on OLIS this afternoon. Pharmacist Ted Simmons of Klamath Falls writes that clinical pharmacy services help to reduce the burden of two healthcare resources due to prevention of rehospitalizations and or repeat visits with specialty providers. Pharmacists provide invaluable continuity of care and a direct resource for patients to help manage their disease states in an outpatient setting. Chiloquin pharmacist Dan Conant tells us that the rural tribal clinic where he works, at that rural tribal clinic, pharmacists manage diabetes and anticoagulation clinics, where pharmacists have clinic appointments with their patients. The pharmacists prescribe and manage disease-specific medications through collaborative drug therapy management agreements that have been created and signed by the patient's referring physician. Pharmacist Laura Simmons writes that community pharmacists may provide medication reconciliation, immunizations, and medication management services, prevent drug-drug or drug-disease errors, educate on medications, and advise which over-the-counter medications to take. Dr. Eric Jones, who works at the VA's community-based outpatient clinic in Grants Pass, says each physician there has upwards of 1,200 patients apiece. Their patients' care is improved through the post-diagnosis work of trained pharmacists. By extending the rural provider tax credit and encouraging these highly trained professionals to locate their practice in rural settings, patients and providers are better served and patient outcomes improved. I'm advocating for the passage of House Bill 2373 with the hope that it will expand access to quality health care for rural Oregonians and reduce costs to hospitals. This is a good bill, and it should pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any questions? I guess I would ask one question and can wait for other witnesses to testify on it. Is there evidence that there's a shortage of pharmacists in the rural area?
Currently, I am awaiting... Chair Greenlick, thank you. I'm currently awaiting word back from the Board of Pharmacy on the exact numbers of pharmacists who are located rurally, but the evidence that I've read so far indicates that the vast majority of pharmacy services, as you might expect, are located in more densely populated urban areas. And there is somewhat of a paucity. If you look at the articles that were provided on OLIS this afternoon, there seems to be a real lack of access to pharmacy services in the rural areas.
And there are open positions that haven't been filled? I guess that's the question.
I wouldn't. What I have read, Chair Greenlick, indicates that it's more about hours that these services are available. So 5 days a week instead of six or seven, things like that. So there may be a pharmacy in Baker, but it may not be open 7 days a week or have the same degree of access for everyone.
I suspect Mrs. Murray will have something to say about that as well when we get there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's call Ann Murray next.
Ann, are you on the phone now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and then we have Danielle Backus and Bill Cross. Do you want to come up?
Ann, why don't you go with it?
Go ahead, Ann.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and fellow members of the Healthcare Committee. My name is Ann Murray from Murray Drug, a family-owned business serving Heppner and Condon and the surrounding four counties in eastern Oregon since 1959. I'm calling you today from our store in Condon, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of 2373 to expand rural tax credits to include pharmacists. I attended one of the Office of Rural Health outreach meetings where retention and recruitment of rural health co-providers was discussed, as they had been instructed to do, to determine what methods are most effective to keep providers and thus access to health care in rural Oregon. Unfortunately, pharmacists are not included in the rural tax credit list of providers, even though we were given provider status in 2015 with passage of House Bill 2028. We are ever expanding our services and continue to be an important member of the healthcare team and are often the most accessible provider to the public. The current pharmacy degree is a doctorate PharmD program consisting of 8 years, 4 years after bachelor's. This degree leaves many students with approximately $180,000 in debt, often at a rate of 6 to 8% interest. With loan payments approaching $2,000 each month, these loan payments can impede young pharmacists from purchasing a home. Recruiting and retaining pharmacists in critical access areas is constantly a challenge, as our areas have to appeal often to the spouse as well as the pharmacist in many cases, with lack of amenities that they may be used to. No McDonald's or movie theaters for at least an hour from us. I understand that the current model of recruitment programs used by Office of Rural Health is sunsetting this year. Another model may be proposed to address the most efficient use of incentive dollars. I urge you to add pharmacists as providers in any programs that may involve rural Oregon practitioners. Pharmacists have also been absent from most loan repayment programs, except if they're nonprofit, in Oregon as well, which I hope to address in testimony for House Bill 2046 in the near future, which was introduced by Representative Greg Smith. Tax credits are a valuable tool to encourage rural pharmacists to continue to serve in our areas. I urge you to add pharmacists as providers in any programs that may involve rural Oregon practitioners. Investing in pharmacists is a smart move for healthcare in rural Oregon. Thank you.
If you'll hold on for questions, we'll wait for the rest of the panel and then ask you some questions too. Go ahead, please. You're next.
So I'm Danielle Backus. I'm a faculty over at Pacific University, and I teach in the School of Pharmacy. I want to kind of reiterate some of the main points that people have been bringing up, the disease states that pharmacists can manage. Some other disease states that haven't been mentioned are heart failure. Pharmacists are really good at getting people on medications that keep them out of the hospital and making sure that their doses are appropriate and don't go beyond a safe measure. Oftentimes, the best practice I've seen so far is when a physician has diagnosed the patient, but they need somebody else to manage the medications because either they're too busy or it's difficult for the patient to understand. And the pharmacist is specially trained in that area, and that's huge in rural areas. Working at a private institution, I do see kind of the financial impact that can have on pharmacy students. Pacific does the best job we can to keep the tuition low, which so does OHSU and OSU, but it's expensive to pay for a bunch of faculty. And so, yeah, our students are definitely graduating with about $200,000 in debt, and that is pretty daunting going out into practice. So I think a tax credit is something that could get students to want to go to a rural area.
Graduates are not going to rural areas.
No, I've seen this across the country. So just so you know, I grew up in Kansas and then went to school in Iowa and came here. So I saw this as well in Kansas, where University of Kansas actually started a second satellite in Wichita, Kansas, trying to draw students to go into rural health that way. And that actually didn't work. The students were going to that rural area to go to school, but then they still want to practice in urban communities. And so you will see there is still kind of everywhere across the country, there's a shortage of pharmacists in rural areas, not just Oregon. So,
great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bill? We can stipulate the value of pharmacy. I think we don't have to debate that. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists, and we urge you to support this legislation. I'm really speaking on behalf of Gary DeLander, a dean with the Department of Pharmacy at OSU, and he also reviewed their records, and I believe their average student there is leaving with about $120,000 of loan debt, and he indicated that it is very hard to entice pharmacists with that kind of debt who have been to school for 8 years to look at rural settings, particularly since there's very few signing bonuses. You're often looking at working for independent care providers as opposed to, you know, larger facilities, larger organizations, chains. So it's it is a challenge, and this would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And I remember a pleasant conversation with your mother-in-law and Hepner one night at dinner when we were visiting. And she talked about the problem of trying to keep pharmacists recruited to your various stores. Can you give us an update on that? How's it been going lately?
Well, we are not open on Saturdays. It's my husband and I and a part-time fill-in. We have to bring relief from La Grande or Hermiston or Tri-Cities. So we couldn't stay open on the weekend because we were raising kids and we couldn't do that. We see the same issues that like our medical providers have, and that I mentioned you have to kind of make the spouse happy too if they're going to live here. And you know, we just don't have as many things that they're used to. We can't pay the kind of salaries that the chains can, especially California chains. We're recruiting some of recent graduates here from Oregon. It's hard to stay open the hours that they need. You know, if we had more people, we could be open Saturdays. We'd like to offer clinical type services too. We need to get a PharmD. We would like to get a young graduate PharmD. So that's about it. I think that the debt is the big thing for them. They're looking to knock that debt out as fast as they can by going for the chains or, you know, larger metropolitan areas.
Mm-hmm. Another question to this panel? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can hang in if you like for the rest. Can you call the next panel?
Sure. Dr. David Pollack and Marcia Kelly.
Dr. Pollack signed up to talk about the bill that we're not hearing today, so he'll make some comments on that as well.
Chair Greenlick and members of the Healthcare Committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And I marked neutral on the bill because although it is a very notable cause, is this the right approach to attract and then retain pharmacists in Oregon? Tax credits have sort of taken over the amount of money that you can appropriate to other things, and I would wonder whether a more appropriate method would be to lower the cost of education by having better funding for our university systems, thus making it easier when people get out of school to be able to locate in different areas. When you were questioning Chris Alanak from LRO about what sort of process you should do before sending it on to the Tax Credit Committee, if it goes to the Tax Credit Committee, I might point you to Senator Dingfelder's evaluations when she was chair of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee, because she took sending a tax credit on very seriously and did address some of the issues that the tax credit review bill really wanted to have happen. I've been testifying on tax credits in the building since 2001, and so I've sort of followed the progression of examining them and seeing whether they're really going to do what they hope to intend to do. So at a minimum, there needs to be ways of checking to see if this goes forward, whether it actually is doing what you're hoping it would do.
Thank you. Dr. Pollack?
Hi. So my name is David Pollack, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm professor of public policy at several departments at OHSU, psychiatry, family medicine, public health and preventive medicine, your old department, and and the Division of Management, where we teach health management. But I serve on two state committees, the Values-Based Benefits Subcommittee of the Health Evidence Review Commission, and I'm chairing the Healthcare Workforce Committee for the State Health Policy Board. So it's in that capacity that I'm here today, not speaking for the committee or for the health authority or the health policy board for myself, but reflecting what I think are meaningful perspectives from that committee. Our charge is to coordinate efforts to recruit and educate healthcare professionals and to retain a quality workforce. This committee was created as a result of House Bill 2009. You, the legislature, have said that this work is necessary if the state's going to meet the demand created by the expansion of healthcare coverage, which we hope will continue expanding, system transformation, and an increasingly diverse population, and to do so in ways that are consistent with the triple, now the quadruple aim. Our committee includes leaders from many health professional disciplines, healthcare payers, provider organizations, academic and training programs, community representatives, and traditional healthcare workers. Since the beginning of the committee in 2010, we've reviewed projections of provider demand in Oregon in response to an expansion of healthcare coverage. We've developed recommendations that remove barriers for new training programs to respond to changes in the market. And we've identified skills and competencies that are needed for the future healthcare system. One of the major projects that we did was the development of a strategic plan for primary care recruitment and retention as a result of House Bill 2366 that was introduced by Representative Nathanson. The plan we developed had three basic strategies to help grow the primary care workforce in Oregon: grow our own, attract from the outside, and empower our communities to better recruit and retain primary care workforce that they need. During this time, we also identified the need for more graduate medical education in Oregon, and in part due to our efforts, the GME consortium was established. Our committee vice chair, Robin Dreibelbus, who's a physician at Comp Northwest, the osteopathic training program in Lebanon, is also on that consortium. For several years, our committee has worked, and we've been trying to understand and maximize the various state and federal provider incentives, which is part of the focus of today's bills. And these have been designed to really get people, in particular, to the rural and underserved areas of the state. In 2013, the committee was charged with doing an analysis of the incentive programs and that were available to healthcare providers, and we completed a thorough review and assessment of these programs in 2016. That final report's available on our website. So with regard to those bills that we're hearing today, and just a brief comment about the other bill that's not being heard today, with House Bill 2373, there is clearly a need for pharmacists in rural Oregon. The bill would expand the provisions of the Rural Medical Provider Tax Credit to include pharmacist services that could play a role in supporting that goal. Interestingly, though, our report that I just mentioned on the effectiveness of the incentive programs found that the tax credit didn't play a substantial role in recruitment of providers to rural Oregon, as you were saying earlier, Chair Greenlick. However, once people were in those places, the tax credit did have an impact on them remaining in those places and continuing to practice. During the listening sessions that we held around the state in the past year, in as part of that report preparation, many providers spoke about the high debt burden they face and that the tax credit helps ease the burden of that debt. The only problem would be the fiscal impact. If this bill or similar legislation is adopted, the inclusion of this class of health professionals should not create unintended consequences of reducing access to the tax credit for other provider disciplines, nor should the funding increase be obtained by reducing other essential health services. Some people have spoken about maybe there could be some either proportional size of the tax credit depending on the amount of debt burden, or that there might be a bonus in relation to people who worked in more critically underserved areas. If it's okay, I'd talk about House Bill 2571. I'm 2751 now, but if you want, I can wait until later.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So that legislation.
Hold on a minute. I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2751, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, so, go for it.
Okay. This legislation does two things. It expressly includes occupational therapists in the pool of providers who are eligible to receive funds under the Oregon's Primary Care Loan Repayment Program. It also extends that loan repayment program in statute to 2020, as opposed to letting the program sunset this year, as it is scheduled to do. The history of the current version of the Primary Care Loan Repayment Program is that it was repurposed by the legislature in 2013 under the leadership of Senator Steiner Hayward to help ensure that Oregon had an adequate health care workforce to provide services to the newly eligible Medicaid population. This program has been operating since 2014 under the oversight of the Health Authority, with the Office of Rural Health providing administrative support by contract. With funding of $6 million from the legislature, the authority has made 66 loan repayment awards to primary care, dental, and behavioral health clinicians in rural and non-rural communities. The first cohort of providers will complete their service commitments at the end of this month, and they plan to remain in their practices after the obligation ends. This program has been highly successful from a retention perspective and in relation to how smoothly and effectively the partnership between OHA and the Office of Rural Health has functioned. Adding occupational therapists to this program may be a valuable benefit for that discipline, and I wouldn't argue against it. But without additional funding, similar to my concerns about the prior bill, my concern would be that those who were initially intended to be able to benefit from it may not. More than 500 clinicians applied for the loan repayment under the program that I just described, and only 66 were able to receive awards due to funding limitations. Adding additional clinical disciplines without commensurate funding increases will simply increase the pool of applicants to compete for a small number of awards. I'm also concerned about not allowing this program to sunset as is scheduled this year. The Workforce Committee is preparing to work with the Office of Rural Health, the OHA, and others to develop a new health care provider incentive fund that should begin next year. This incentive fund is a super fund, if you will, allowing us to target money to where it can best be used in the state. Maintaining the currently siloed programs, such as the loan repayment program, in their existing form would work at cross purposes to this new program's intent. We would instead invite all groups to join us as we develop a better and more collaborative system of incentives that you, the legislature, have already said you preferred. House Bill 3261, sponsored by Representative Nathanson and Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Manas Anderson, moves us forward in this direction. If I could make a brief comment about House Bill 2524, the committee absolutely agrees that adding more graduate medical education training slots targeted to critical practice areas, including family medicine and psychiatry, as Representative Bueller has put in his bill, it's an important strategy. Pardon?
We're not sure about psychiatry.
I'm sure about it. It's an important strategy to build the healthcare workforce that we need in Oregon. We're excited to hear of our first new residency program being initiated at Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg. If loans to hospitals will contribute to more to GME in Oregon, we're happy to support that concept. My main concerns, however, have to do with that funding mechanism. Since we're apparently not going to be talking more about that, I won't say more about that, except that I think House Bill 3085 has what seems to be a more robust, sustainable, and feasible funding mechanism that would allow startup of those kinds of residency programs and the other health professional funding supports that were built into that bill. I would only suggest, and this is from a psychiatric perspective, that one amendment to add to whatever bill relates to that would be something that would specify that psychiatry residents trained through such programs would be required, that the training programs would require a certain minimum amount of time for them to learn about and to work in integrated care settings, primary care homes, general medical clinics, and so forth, for them to get that needed consultation experience that is really one of the main directions that psychiatry is going into now. So we recognize there are substantial challenges facing the legislature when it comes to the general fund and how to pay for everything. We ask that you keep in mind the importance of funding these health care provider incentives, whatever they are, at levels that are adequate to achieve a more fully functioning and sufficient healthcare workforce. The Health Policy Board provided our committee with our new charter last week. Over the next 2 years, we have been charged to work with educational institutions and leaders in various health professions to identify and develop the essential competencies within the healthcare disciplines, to compile and recommend promising strategies for increasing the diversity of the healthcare workforce, and to help to realign Oregon's various provider incentives into a more effective and easily navigated system to place health care providers in the areas where they're most needed. We look forward to being a resource to you as we all move forward. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Are there any questions in the panel?
Yeah. Yeah.
Representative Buehler has a question.
Representative Buehler? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I appreciate your testimony, and one of the reasons I asked the chair to withdraw 2524 is because I think Senator Steiner Hayward's bill 3085 is more elegant solution to the problem than what I crafted, and I'll be supporting that.
Terrific.
What do you think, based on your work, the most needed healthcare profession is in rural Oregon right now in terms of lack of access?
I'll say, first of all, for the state, we need more general practice physicians, primary care physicians, either general internists, family medicine providers, as well as general psychiatrists who can do this kind of consultation as we move towards behavioral health primary care integration, but also general surgeons.
Follow-up, please, Chair. Did you look at the need for nursing services?
Yes. I'm talking first about physicians.
Okay.
We certainly need practitioners. The two fastest growing disciplines right now in this state, and I think everywhere else in the country, are physician assistants and nurse practitioners. So we need to continue sustaining the growth of those disciplines, as we expect the role of physicians is changing and will be changing to be more of a mix of providing direct patient care and some consultation and supervision and working with the other members of their teams. And we're also moving more to team-based care throughout our system. Beyond that, other nurses, pharmacists, and some of the other disciplines that we've mentioned, occupational therapy and physical therapy, are all important, as are those traditional healthcare workers that our committee helped to launch that commission, which are community health workers, peer navigators, personal health navigators, and peer advocates and peer wellness specialists.
And one more question, please.
One more.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. You made a statement that you believe that tax credits are not so important in terms of attracting health professionals to a rural area, but rather sustaining their presence there. What's the data that you base that comment on?
Representative Buehler and Chair Greenlick, we got a consultation from the Lewin Group, a highly regarded health policy group that did a lot of the work for us and with us during this year-long, more than a year-long process of House Bill 3396 that we used to create that report. The data they gathered, plus the data we've been getting regularly from earlier the Healthcare Workforce Institute and other groups, including sources within OHA, came to the conclusion that the tax credits are important. They're important more for retention than they are for attracting people. Loan repayment and other kinds of incentives are important as well. One of the features of our report was also, how can we help communities to have a much more efficient way to attract and recruit people, to even share best practices among communities about how they have effectively done that, so that we can kind of mount similar efforts in different parts of the state, especially the coast and the eastern part of the state.
Representative Nose?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Buehler kind of asked my question. I would just point out that...
I know, everything's been said, but I haven't said it.
No. I would just point out that the healthcare report that the witness is referring to is on OLIS, and people should take a look at it. I do have another question, though. So I think the thing I worry about is I struggle with tax credits, too, because they take away from funding for other things. And they're sort of a backdoor way to fund something that we don't necessarily do outright through the Ways and Means process. If we eliminate these tax credits, I worry that we won't allocate the funding to some other program, you know, and then we'll end up with nothing. That's my only worry. Because the budget
worry.
Situation is so bad this year that if we don't, you know, I'm struggling with what's the right way to do. If we eliminate the credit, would we then make a corresponding allocation to a loan forgiveness program or something else so that we, you know, we still have things in our toolbox?
So,
and of course, tax credits aren't going to only compete with other health care tax credits. They're going to compete with the full range of tax credits that are
So, Vice Chair Nasi and Chair Greenlick, I hope I didn't convey an impression that I'm for ending the tax credits.
Okay.
Not at all. We think they're important. They're another arrow in the quiver, so to speak. They serve a purpose of helping to retain people. They're just less effective in recruiting people.
Okay.
But the retention is equally important. And the tax from the people we heard, I was at the listening sessions in Lebanon and Astoria, and other colleagues from our committee were at Prineville and I forget where it was, in Eastern Oregon, maybe Pendleton, all heard the same thing, that those tax credits are very important. Please don't stop them.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up comment, not a question.
Go ahead.
I believe these credits are in the governor's recommended budget. I think she recommended that we keep them. I'm hopeful that we'll figure out some way to figure out our revenue shortfall, because if we don't, this is going to be really hard.
It's going to be hard anyway.
Can I ask one?
Yeah.
Thank you. Does the data show which professions have a harder time attracting people to rural areas versus other professions that might have a harder time retaining? Or does it all fall kind of 50-50? How does it break out?
Representative Kenny Geyer and Chair Greenlick, I can't give you the exact numbers. I can tell you that it's hard to recruit any discipline to rural areas. It's harder to get specialists and subspecialists there, but we're working out better ways to use telelink methodologies to have them providing consultation on an ongoing basis. One program I can recommend highly is something called the ECHO Project that we're doing at OHSU to connect a number of safety net clinics around the state with psychiatric consultation and pharmaceutical or pharmacological consultation. The problem is really getting enough primary care providers and the various disciplines that provide primary care into those communities and retaining them in a sufficient number that you don't end up having people burn out because they're having to cover for positions that were vacated. It's a common problem that we've seen throughout the state, on the coast, in central and eastern Oregon in particular. I think this is true of nursing professionals as well. It may be a little bit easier to get nurse practitioners and physician assistants to work in some of those areas, but there are a number of primary care physicians, DOs and MDs, that will go there as well, given sufficient support.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. So I just want to kind of recap here what I think I'm hearing, that and correct me if I'm wrong, that at this point, to eliminate or to sunset these tax credits really could hurt our rural health community to do it before we have something else in place if we are going to do something else. Is that a correct statement, or are you advocating for eliminating them and then putting something else in place?
Chair Greenlick.
This is a national debate.
Right? Vice Chair
and replace
Hayden.
The debate.
I'm not advocating that at all. I'm advocating that we need to retain the tax credits. If we're going to add disciplines, we actually may need to expand them. We need to have all of the incentive mechanisms, state-funded as well as federal-funded. If you look at our report, we have a number of different funds. There are loans, there are scholarships, there's tax credits that all make this package as effective as it is. We think there needs to be more of that support. And we just feel strongly that the centralization of the administration of that into one entity, the superfund that I described, is a more efficient way of doing that, so that we can try to factor in who are the disciplines that need it where and what are the amounts of money or which package of things would be helpful. One of the pieces of feedback we got on these listening tours and from others was how confusing that various application processes were for people for different kinds of sources of funding, and the timing of them, and whether or not there had to be a commitment to hire the person before they got the commitment of getting the resources from the fund and so forth. We're trying to streamline that.
But we're going to move on to the next hearing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2373 and continue the public hearing on House Bill 2751 with one more panel.
Angela Mart, Katie Smith, and Jeanette Baker. And Mr. Chair, while they're coming, this bill...
Can you tell us about this?
Well, just to remind you, this allows occupational therapists to participate in the Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Program.
Okay. Any order?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the Committee for Healthcare. My name is Angela Mart. I am the first full-time occupational therapist in Wallowa County. I am currently assisting Wallowa Memorial Hospital in Enterprise,
Oregon. You
came
a long way.
I did, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I am assisting Wallowa Memorial Hospital in Enterprise in starting an occupational therapy program. I am also the regional director of Eastern Oregon for the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon. I am here today to speak in support of HB 2751, the bill that would allow occupational therapists to participate in the Primary Care Provider Loan Repayment Program. Occupational therapists play an important role in a patient's healing process. We have the opportunity to teach them how to live as independently as possible in their new body after they have experienced a temporary or permanent disability. These include hip and knee replacements, stroke, traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cerebral palsy, ADHD, autism. The list goes on. How do you put on your shirt when your left arm no longer functions after a stroke? How do you continue to see the controls on the microwave when your vision is failing as you get older? How do you engage with your child who has autism? An occupational therapist can teach you those skills. I brought with me today a quote from one of my patients that I've had the opportunity to work with in Wallowa County over the past year. I just want to say thank you to Wallowa Memorial Hospital, especially occupational therapy. I lost half of my ring finger and part of three other fingers on my left hand in March 2016 in a table saw accident. At that time, my only concern was being able to use the clutch on my Harley. With occupational therapy, I was able to rehab my hand and was soon back on my bike doing what I love best. Occupational therapists also play a vital role in the multidisciplinary team that usually consists of doctors, nurses, social workers, pharmacists, physical therapy, and speech therapy. As we treat the whole patient, we have insight into how successful a patient is going to be after discharge from a hospital setting. We assist the team in determining the appropriate discharge setting, any medical or adaptive equipment the patient may need to be more independent, and we can go into the home after discharge to ensure the patient will be able to navigate their home environment safely and participate in their daily activities effectively. Often during our treatments, we will gain insight into other needs that will also set the patient up for success at home, like Meals on Wheels or a caregiver to assist with self or home care the patient may no longer be able to do on their own. All of this leads to keeping the patient in the home and reducing hospital admissions. Currently, I want you to keep in mind that in the total state of Oregon, there are approximately 2,400 occupational therapists and certified occupational therapists or assistants. Sorry. Currently, there are 32 occupational therapists in 10 counties in eastern Oregon: Baker, Gillam, Grant, Harney, Malheur, Morrow, Umatilla, Union, Wallowa, Wheeler. As the new regional director of Eastern Oregon, I mailed a letter and survey to each of those 32 occupational therapists in early February. To date, I have had a 30% response rate and expect more surveys to be returned. Of those responses, 60% of the occupational therapists are currently paying back school loans from occupational therapy school. So far, 90% of occupational therapists who have responded support adding occupational therapists to the loan repayment program and feel it could be a good incentive to attract more occupational therapists to Eastern Oregon. I brought with me today also a letter from two of the physicians that work at Wallowa Memorial Hospital. And it's a very long letter. She's very passionate about occupational therapy. So I'm going to just read some excerpts from it.
If you submit it to put in the record, that would be fine.
I would love to. I am writing to request support for loan repayment for occupational therapists in rural critical access areas. Our occupational therapist plays a critical role in both inpatient and outpatient realms of medicine. As many rural counties in Oregon, we have a large geriatric population. Given our rural location, we do not have any nursing homes in our county. Many of our elderly live at home and have very few options for assisted living or intermediate levels of care. Our occupational therapist is able to do home visits and perform home safety evaluations. She provides in-depth reports on home conditions and ability to perform activities of daily living. Her information gives us great confidence in our discharge plans, reduces readmission, and helps our patients out of the helps keep our patients out of the ER. We are also able to target high-risk patients and have our occupational therapist do similar evaluations in the outpatient setting. We would not want to work in a hospital without an occupational therapist! Exclamation mark. As you can see...
Do you have unfilled positions in Eastern Oregon?
I'm sorry?
Are there unfilled positions for occupational therapy?
Yes. I had the opportunity to speak with the physical therapist supervisor in Harney County. I believe it's Harney District Hospital. And they would love to attract an occupational therapist, but they have not been able to and are hoping to be able to do so one day. And so I was talking with him about this bill, and his opinion was that possibly that having school loan repayment as an extra incentive might attract an OT to their area. I also, when I worked at St. Charles and Bend for 6 years, and when I was getting ready to leave St. Charles, I was looking around for what my next step would be, and I was keeping an eye on a position open in Lakeview, which is not part of my area, but Lakeview, and they had an occupational therapy part-time position open for well over a year. I don't know if it's been filled yet, but I know that it was open when I was looking. So I do feel that there is a need.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
As you can see, occupational therapy plays an important role in a patient's healing process, really one of the primary roles in their healing process. I encourage you to support HB 2751, the bill that would allow occupational therapists to participate in the primary care provider loan repayment program. And also, sir, I'm the first OT in Wallowa County, and right now I'm a generalist. I've had a very steep learning curve for areas that I wasn't practicing in Bend, but I'm learning to do out there, and I would love to have another OT someday to help me. So I'm hoping that's my goal, is to grow my program out there.
Great.
Thank you.
Next.
My name is Katie Smith. Representative Greenlick, members of the Healthcare Committee. My name is Katie Smith. I'm an occupational therapy student, and I am very interested in working in a rural community. I'm very interested in working in primary care. I have over $100,000 in debt, as do many of my colleagues who are with me today, and this bill is of great personal interest to me. I'd just like to spend a little bit of time going over some recent studies that speak of the efficacy of occupational therapy in addressing some of the needs that are specific to the underserved and rural Oregonians. A large proportion of rural Oregonians are older adults, and occupational therapy is very distinctly qualified at addressing the functional needs and preserving function in older adults so that they can age in place and stay at home and have valuable lives. Occupational therapy also helps prevent falls in older adults, which is falls can precipitate expensive hospital stays and ultimately can be fatal. Occupational therapy is also very skilled at helping people self-manage their chronic and complex conditions, including diabetes, obesity, and hypertension. Occupational therapy in the state of Oregon is a qualified mental health professional, which means that within our profession, we can diagnose and address mental health concerns and as well as addiction, which, as we know, is far too prevalent in our rural communities. And a recent study came out and said that occupational therapy is was the only service in a hospital that prevented readmission into the hospitals after discharge. So if we're that effective at preventing readmission, just think of how effective we can be at preventing those admissions in the first place by preserving function and maximizing the quality of life, improving patient outcomes and health outcomes, and ultimately saving costs. And as I mentioned earlier, occupational therapy students have a large amount of debt, and as do many of the other professionals that are already listed in the loan repayment program. However, many of those professionals have a myriad of loan repayment programs to choose from, but this would be a singular draw for occupational therapy, and it would be an incentive not only to retain occupational therapists working in settings that she works in, that I would like to work in, but it really would be an incentive to attract us towards those settings. And I can say that because it would be an attraction for me. Representative Greenlick, members of the Healthcare Committee, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. And thank all your colleagues for joining you. Thank you guys for coming.
Can I ask a quick question, Chair?
Oh. Sure.
Thank you, Chair. How many years of school, on average, in comparison to others that are in the loan program, does it take to become an occupational therapist?
Representative Hack, I am Representative Greenlick. I am in my second of 3 years of my doctoral program, and there's a four-year undergraduate program as a prerequisite to this program.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Nose and Hayden, and members of the Health Care Committee, my name is Janet Baker. I serve as Executive Director of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. You may wonder why I'm here, but I have a reason. We are speaking in support of HB 2751. And I represent 800 optometric physicians, students, educators, and eye health industry professionals in Oregon. They, along with their thousands of optometric staff, operate in every county across Oregon, providing more than two-thirds of primary eye care to children and families across the state. Many times, optometric physicians are the only eye health professionals in some rural areas throughout Oregon. As primary health care providers, doctors of optometry have extensive and ongoing training to examine, diagnose, treat, and manage ocular disorders, diseases, injuries, and systemic diseases that manifest in the eye, in addition to serving the vision needs of their patients. These comprehensive eye exams often prevent or at least early diagnose eye and potentially life-threatening conditions. For instance, in 2014, more than 250,000 cases of diabetes were first diagnosed by optometric physicians and then referred to medical doctors for important co-management of diabetes-related eye conditions such as diabetic retinopathy, glaucoma, and other conditions. Optometric physicians attain their undergraduate degrees, most often in a science field such as biology or chemistry, etc. The average undergraduate student loan in Oregon is about $26,000. They then go through a very competitive process of applying for graduate school at an accredited college of optometry. Most optometric physicians practicing in Oregon graduate from Pacific University College of Optometry in Forest Grove. Upon graduation from optometry school, many continue to further their studies in residencies and private practice with the VA and rural health, etc. According to the Oregonian, last year alone, students attending college in Oregon and their parents borrowed $1.3 billion, the sixth straight year the volume has exceeded the billion-dollar mark. It represents a 103% jump from just a decade ago, when annual borrowing reached $655 million. By 2013, more than 6 in 10 Oregon college students left school owing an average of more than $26,000. By the time students graduate from optometry school, these young optometric physicians have often additionally incurred more than $170,000 to $250,000 in student debt. If they plan to open their own private practice, they also incur equipment and potentially mortgage debt for an additional $250,000 or more in order to be able to provide the critically important eye health and vision care they have devoted 8 to 10 years obtaining the license to provide. With this
getting somewhere related to this bill?
Yes, exactly. I I'm getting ready to ask that in addition to medical doctors, occupational therapists, and other health care providers, optometric physicians would ask to be included in either a loan repayment program or in tax credits or in any other mechanisms that might be provided to make it possible for them to practice in rural areas throughout the state. I thank you for your...
You're proposing an amendment?
No, we're not proposing an amendment. We just support the bill and would like to be included as it goes to work session or to any further study for what the impact of tax credits would be that optometry be included.
Okay, great. Thank you. We hear you. We require an amendment. We'll work on it. Thank you. Are there any questions to this panel? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We close the public hearing on House Bill 2751 and open a work session on House Bill 2397. Madam Minister, what do we have here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2397 had a public hearing on February 3rd. It creates a nine-member public health and pharmacy formulary advisory committee within the Board of Pharmacy, specifies the membership, duties, and responsibilities of the committee, directs the State Board of Pharmacy to establish by rule the formulary drugs and devices that the pharmacist may prescribe and dispense to patients under specific condition. Mr. Chair, we have a dash two amendment that has been agreed upon by the Oregon Medical Association, the Nurses Association, State Board of Pharmacy, and the Pharmacy Coalition. The dash two amendment modifies the Public Health and Pharmacy Formulary Advisory Committee by reducing the original nine member to seven members, and it consists of two licensed physicians, three advanced practice registered nurses, and three pharmacists.
Two physicians, two nurses.
Right.
And three pharmacists.
Correct. We have a minimal expenditure on the dash two amendments and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
And everybody is okay with, I don't hear any head shaking, no. The assumption would be everybody's agreed to it. Okay, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2397, dated March 8th, 2017.
Representative Nose moves the dash two amendments dated March 8th, 2017, House Bill 2397. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
No.
Is there any objection to the amendment? So moved. Representative
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2397 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Nose moves House Bill 2397 as amended with a dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Excuse me. Is there any discussion about the motion?
There is.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Green. I think the concept behind this bill is fantastic, and I'm hoping that the future can work collaboratively on having less bills brought before the legislature on these types of medications and things that we have to deal with, that we can get access to the people that need access to it in a manner that both boards and practitioners can agree on without coming to the legislature for that fight. So thank you.
As we do some of that. Okay, any other discussion? Could you please call the motion? I mean, call the roll.
Representative Kenny Dyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leone.
Aye.
Representative Kenimer.
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Pack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Aye.
Chair Green.
Aye. Motion carried. Mr. Buehler, would you like to carry this one?
Sure.
I'm going to carry it. Close the work session on House Bill 2397 and open a work session on House Bill 2644. Madam Administrator, what do we got?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2644 is before the committee at the request of Representative Malmstrom. We had a public hearing on the bill on February 20th. back before us again today. This provides the administration of vitamin K by injection to newborn infants. You have the Dash 3 amendment in front of you. The Dash 3 amendment removes the references to oral and injection and replaces it with the phrase, the most effective procedures for administering vitamin K. Mr. Chair, there is no revenue impact on the Dash 3 amendment and a minimal fiscal impact with the Dash 3 amendment.
Representative Malmstrom, you have a comment? Would you like to comment on this?
I'm going
to
move the amendment first.
Well, no, that's all right.
You are?
Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say I enjoyed working on this bill. It came to my attention a long time ago, and I was very happy to work with my colleagues to make it even better and focus on truly the issue, which is the best practice to make sure that infants are safe. So thank you, everybody, and I hope we can move this amendment to the floor.
Representative Notes, you have a motion.
I do, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2644, dated March 3rd, 2017.
Representative Notes moves the Dash 3 amendments, dated March 3rd, 2017, to House Bill 2644. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? The Dash 3 is added to House Bill 2644.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2644 as amended with the Dash 3 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2644 as amended with the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Can I ask a quick clarifying question?
There is some.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure that the Dash 3s cover the fact that it makes it optional for the injection. And that, am I in the wrong one? Nope, this
oh,
is
I
right.
Think you're in the right place.
And that parents are given a choice first. Am I right?
Yes.
Parents are definitely given a choice, but what this says is the physician's responsibility was to propose what they think is the most effective. The parent obviously has a choice in this.
And they do that prior to doing the injection, they'll consult with, that's part of the Dash 3, right?
I think they would have to do that prior to doing the injection.
Right.
Okay.
It's important consent.
I just wanted to add that, thank you, Chair, that it's always been part of informed consent, always has been, so that doesn't change. So.
Okay.
Yeah, the proposal was to only propose the injection by law to take away the
option. And this takes care of that,
this
right?
This simply gives the provider the option to decide what to offer.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Malmstrom?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2644 as amended with the Dash 3 on its way to the floor. Representative Malmstrom, would you carry it?
Yes, I'd be grateful to that.
All right. Representative Malmstrom will carry the bill. Is there any other business to be brought before the committee?
We think so. Maybe.
Once we gavel out.
Business before.
Don't go anywhere.
We are adjourned.
Everybody stay.
We are adjourned.
Everybody stay anywhere.